I just wouldn't go out and buy it. I mean, these are, you know, these are really artifacts of something so horrible that what is the draw? I mean, I don't know. We'll have to take him at his word, but it gives me the willies, honestly.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Adam Cohen, lawyer, journalist, former member of the New York Times editorial board, will link to your New York Times guest essay. 54 years ago, a Supreme Court justice was forced to quit for behavior arguably less egregious than Thomas's. Adam Cohen is also author of Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, and Irene Sheehan.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
Stand up now, stand up now, you noble diggers all, stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name, your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers are bold, to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold, stand up now, diggers all. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, the lawyers they conjoin, stand up now. To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise, the devil in them lies, and hath blinded both their eyes, stand up now. The clergy they come in, stand up now, the clergy they come in, stand up now. The clergy they come in and say it is a sin that we should now begin our freedom for to win, stand up now, diggers all. The gentry are all round, stand up now, the gentry are all round, stand up now. The gentry are all round, on each side they are found, their wisdom so profound, to cheat us of our ground, stand up now. The club is all their law, stand up now, the club is all their law, stand up now. The club is all their law, to keep poor men in awe, that they no vision saw, to maintain such a law, stand up now, diggers all.
Indeed, what a great way to start a show. That was Chumbawamba, the great English anarchist band, English Rebel Songs, 1381 to 1984, in the name of all the poor oppressed in the land of England. And that was the Diggers' Song, written in 1649 by Gerard Winstanley, leader of the Diggers. The Diggers, unable, I'm reading from their pamphlet in this CD, unable and unwilling to pay exorbitant rents to rich landlords, took over wasteland, meaning unused. There's probably things growing there, so it wasn't totally wasted, but anyway, and began to rebuild their own community. Time after time, they were attacked by local soldiers under orders from the priests and lords. Their growing crops were pulled up and discarded. The Diggers, staunch pacifists, were repeatedly beaten up but offered no physical resistance. Moving from place to place and encouraging others to follow their example, they struggled on for 2 years, preaching a vision of common ownership of the land and shared labor. The Diggers taught us by nature of their example that common and equal work without lords or masters can be a practical alternative to the robber and inequality of capitalism. And in parentheses, they also unwittingly taught us the folly of accepting the violence and destruction of the state without fighting back. St. George's Hill, the most famous of the diggers' plots of squatted land, is now a highly select residential area full of well-to-do stock brokers. Indeed. So here's a quote from Gerard Winstanley, who, let's see, was an English Protestant religious reformer, political philosopher, and activist during the period of the Commonwealth of England. He was the leader and one of the founders of the English group known as the True Levellers or Diggers. The group occupied formerly common land, and that's important because, you know, the Enclosures Act, fundamental to the establishment of the capitalist hegemonic system and the rise of industrialization that led to the impoverishment of so many and the devastation of the earth, including the biggest cumulative impact of all global climate change. Anyway, formerly common land that had been privatized by enclosures and dug them over, pulling down hedges and filling in ditches to plant crops. Okay, that's Gerard Winstanley and the Diggers. Here's a quote. Thoughts ran in me that words and writing were nothing and must die, for action is the essence of all, and if thou dost not act, thou dost nothing. Of course, I'm reading that from a book, so, you know, we're all caught in the contradictions. That's from the issue 10, the final issue of Do or Die, Voices from the Ecological Resistance. I was lucky enough to get to know and actually stay in the house in Brighton where some of the folks who put this together, they were kind of part of the core group and then sort of a splinter group off of Earth First in England, in the UK, which was inspired by the Earth First movement here in the United States. Anyway, amazing compendium. It's like 360 pages long, full of really good stuff. You can find it. It's archived online. It might be like doordie.org. Really worth checking out. They got some really good stuff. I might read a little bit from Down with Empire, Up with the Spring, appropriate for now, article in there. Gerard Winstanley, notwithstanding, that kind of rhymes there. I'm going to read from a few books, but I'm mainly going to talk about direct action. What is it? How does it differ from other forms of, struggle, activism? And have you done it? Let's talk about experiences. Sometimes I think that there's sort of the world is divided between those who've been intensely involved in direct activism and those who haven't, because standing up to power, it creates a certain dynamic, creates a certain awareness and consciousness in you that unless you've done it, it's hard to have access to it. I don't know. What do you think about that? Is that controversial? I also want to read, as I said, I'm going to talk about, this is all, because Earth Day is coming up this Saturday. By the way, KBOO is having a whole day of special programming around that, so stay tuned for that. I want to read a little bit from The Green Revolution, the American Environmental Movement, 1962 to 1992. God, that's stuffed 30 years ago. There's been books written, about it since, but this was, at its time, this was a really a slim volume. It's only about 120 pages, and it's a really valuable history, really succinct history. So I want to talk a little bit, because Earth Day is coming up, and this is, I guess, Earth Week, maybe, I don't know. So I want to sort of set the stage. He, along with many others, date the beginning of the modern environmental movement. Of course, the environmental movement has been around, as long as there have been people trying to, the diggers were in an environmental movement in a sense. Why it became the environmental movement is a particular history, as opposed to, you know, struggle against the powers that be who are trying to both oppress people and control them and basically, you know, level the trees to build their boats for their navies, et cetera, or for their imperial structures. It goes hand in hand. Abuse of power is always affects our living environment and our societies and communities. Okay, so he dates it, like so many others, to the publication of Silent Spring in 1962. And I'll just read a little bit of this to give you a sense. Silent Spring was an immediate emphatic success on the New York Times bestseller list for 31 weeks, and with hardcover sales of more than 500,000 copies, rare for a serious nonfiction book. Its detailed and powerful condemnation of the American pesticide industry, particularly its startling case against DDT, touched a chord clearly waiting to be touched, made up in equal parts of a growing uneasiness with the it was published, by the way, in 1962, made up in equal parts of a growing uneasiness with the world of post-war technology and a growing awareness of the non-material amenities of life. Viciously attacked by the chemical industry, which mounted a $250,000 campaign, probably would have been, you know, $250 million or, well, millions now today, to prove Carson a hysterical fool, the book eventually won awards from the National Wildlife Federation and the Audubon Society, caused a wide popular outcry against the overuse of pesticides, and led directly to a Presidential Scientific Advisory Committee to report in 1963 that corroborated Carson's work and reaffirmed her criticism of the pesticide interests. Ultimately, it played a part in gaining support for the Pesticide Control Act of 1972 and the Toxic Substance Control Act of 1976. And I will interject here. Of course, we know there is massive loopholes. You know, if Roundup is still out there and so many others, you know, there's the whole critique of the whole regulatory industry that basically they're a way to let industry keep going without, without attacking directly the capitalist system, which needs this constant innovation, constant pumping things out without massively testing, and then, you know, assuaging the consciences by outlawing some of the most egregious forms. Okay, but more than that, it galvanized, they're talking about Silent Spring, it galvanized a constituency no one had realized was there, energizing the somewhat sluggish traditional conservation groups, as well as many who had never given a thought to the natural world before. Max Nicholson, head of the British Nature Conservancy and a figure of international renown, called it, quote, probably the greatest and most effective single contribution to informing public opinion on the true nature and significance of ecology. American historian Stephen Fox put it even more succinctly, quote, the Uncle Tom's Cabin of modern environmentalism. Of course, the book Uncle Tom's Cabin helped, among so many other things, to ignite the flames of anti-slavery. Of course, and then ironically, Carson got cancer, most likely from the, as Kirkpatrick Sale says, from the very poison she so skillfully analyzed, and died in 1964. Oh, and then he goes on, and it's kind of misleading to date the environmental movement from the summer of 62 for an act of concern for the natural world and alarm at its various perils actually go back through the 20th century into the 19th, et cetera, et cetera. But in another sense, he continues later on, it is fair to say that there was really no such thing as an environmental movement, concerted, populist, vocal, influential, active before the publication of Silent Spring. As late as 1959, a speaker at the North American Wildlife Conference maintained that, quote, the conservation conscience would never be a conviction of the majority of the American people. 3 decades later, polls show that 80% of Americans supported the goals of environmentalism. A tendency had become a tide. Old organizations had taken on new life, and new ones sprang up on all sides. A new sensibility had, in fact, been born. Such a revolution was not created by a single book, to be sure, however influential. The forces that lay behind the movement were multiple and complex. And he talks about the post-war economic boom, the affluent society, which produced not only all the synthetic revolution, the plastics, fibers, chemicals, pesticides, detergents, nuclear power, and the like, and the tracks and developments and suburbs and high-rises fed on it, and yet seemed not to have brought the comfort and harmony and tranquility it had promised. Talked about the lingering existence of widespread poverty that ended up leading to the Great Society, the War on Poverty, and then the general sense of crisis, modern diseases of, quote, affluenza, alcoholism, drugs, suicide, insanity, violence, alienation had increased, and, all the price to pay of all the urban expansion, suburban expansion, urban crowding, suburban sprawl, pollution and smog, clear cuts and dammed rivers, cancer and nuclear fallout had come at a dizzying pace, future shock it was called, that seemed beyond the effective control either of the businesses benefiting from it or of the government supposedly regulating it. In short, the discontents, disjunctions, and discords that were to become the troubles of the 60s were brewing. But at the same time, the post-war material boom had produced a growing number of the college-trained, white-collar middle class that increasingly populated suburbs in search of the trees and birdsong and stars at night. They wanted to concern themselves more with what the sociologists were calling quality of life, QOL, than with standard of living, SOL, in the traditional sense. The amenities beyond the amenities, including leisure time, outdoor recreation, healthy air and water. Basically, that's what created the audience for Silent Spring and for the growth of the environmental movement in general, and which, you know, as later environmental justice movement rightly criticized how it was so white and so tend to be so suburban. But it did create what we know of as the Silent Spring and all these factors helped create the modern environmental movement. So anyway, this book is the story of the first three decades of the environmental movement, its causes and campaigns, its turns and twists. I'll just briefly sketch them. The first from 1962 to the first Earth Day in 1970, the time in which environmentalism was originally forced onto the nation's agenda, changing from the traditional conservationist concern for wilderness areas, because after all, there was the creation of the national parks, the national forests, some first wilderness areas, and to a new focus on threats to human settlements. The second coinciding with the decade of the 70s until the Reagan presidency, during which Washington became the chief battleground and legal reformism the main effort, guided by a dark new perception of approaching doomsday and the human as an endangered species. The third, the years of the Reagan reaction, in which the movement divided into an increasingly professional mainstream and an increasingly radical grassroots, marked by a growing understanding of the Earth itself as somehow endangered. And the last, during Bush's administration, when environmentalism matured in both methods and impact and grew to new heights of membership and money, with both stubborn resistance and bitter frustration in the face of the awareness of stress and fragility and crisis of the biosphere of the only living planet in the new known universe. So that kind of sets the stage. And then I just want to, you know, because Earth Day is coming up, and I don't think that many people really know necessarily that much about it, I just want to read a little bit about Earth Day itself. So this is called the 60s seed time, 1962 to 1970, where, you know, after the publication of Silent Spring, and there is the first big impetus was the towards the protection of wilderness leading up to the Wilderness Act. And Silent Spring was a major factor in that. And the explosion of membership in a lot of the major old-time environmental groups like the Sierra Club, the Audubon. Audubon grew from 62 to 70, grew from 41 to 81,000. They all almost doubled. The National Wildlife Federation from 271 to 540,000. Sierra Club from 1959, 20,000 to 113,000 in 1970. Wilderness Society from 27,000 in 1964 to 54,000 in 1970. So they passed the Wilderness Bill in 1964. And then the whole, the second principal front of the environmental movement in this decade, the one laid out squarely by Rachel Carson and made an important part of the American agenda for the first time, was generally given the broad heading pollution, though in fact it was rather a dawning awareness of the dangers of a full array of human technologies to human health and safety. And one of the original things I wanted to talk about today was artificial intelligence, because there's just so much talk about it. And it is an important subject, which we can bring up, but I'd like to do a future show on artificial intelligence, the rise of, well, the internet, Google, the data centers, and sort of the material underside, how both artificial intelligence and these Google and other data centers use an immense amount of energy and water. The chat rooms, chat bot or chat GPI, whatever it's called, just uses, there's been articles that have just come out, an incredible amount of water. And people don't like to think of, you know, the internet as a material thing, but it really is. It's basically just, you know, it was supposed to do away with, you know, the need for paper, and, you know, it was this whole great new democratic tool, and is going to just lead to the information at the fingertips. And, you know, I admit I use Wikipedia a lot, and I think it is a valuable tool, but we just don't think of the materiality. There's actually all those electrons moving around are generating heat. They have to be stored somewhere. That generates all those all those servers stacked up on end generate an immense amount of heat, need to be cooled. They use an immense amount of electricity, et cetera, just like Bitcoin. Anyway, so yeah, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963, then the growing awareness of smog, mostly from automobiles. The 80 people died in New York City during an air inversion in the summer of 1966. And then the oil spills of the 60s, Santa Barbara, the Cuyahoga River near Cleveland burst into flames in 1969. All these things led to this growing awareness of the toxic environment, which led to the creation of a bunch of organizations like the Environmental Defense Fund, and the whole rise of suing corporations for their impacts. And then, of course, there was Ralph Nader, who, auto safety, all these different Nader's Raiders task forces to study and recommend changes in auto safety, pesticides, nuclear energy, food and drugs, air and water pollution, et cetera, et cetera. Public interest research groups. And of course, so there we are leading up to the first Earth Day in 1970. Mainstream media finally awoke to the issue, and coverage gradually increased throughout the decade, reaching a crescendo in early 1970 with a spate of front page articles and cover stories in Time, Fortune, Newsweek, et cetera, typified by Newsweek's headline, "The Ravaged Environment." Ecology became a word known to, if rarely understood by, the average citizen. And he has a little footnote here. Despite headline writers, ecology is not the same thing as environment. The environment is what is out there. Ecology is how we study it, specifically the relation of species to each other and to their environment. Okay. Anyway, ecology became a word known to, if not rarely understood by, the average citizen. And arcane phrases like environmental costs, resource depletion, atmospheric inversion, et cetera, were becoming common currency. The ecology issue has assumed the dimensions of a vast popular fad, said Robert Heilbronner. But he also said the ecology issue is not only one of primary and lasting importance, but may indeed constitute the most dangerous and difficult challenge that humanity has ever faced. Certainly the climate crisis. Well, that and war, and of course, as I've repeatedly said, well, war and it's all connected, folks. But the way I see it, in terms of our existential threats, war, including nuclear weapons, and the vast war industry, and the climate crisis are at the top of my list in terms of what's threatening our very collective existence. Our individual and community existence, of course, are constantly threatened by oppression, racism, and police abuse and other things. Anyway, I can't do everything. I'm just talking about Earth Day right now. The high point of that phenomenon was an event called, with typical 60s grandeur, Earth Day 1970. It began with a speech by Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson in Seattle in 1969, which he proposed a kind of nationwide teach-in on college campuses, following the model of the anti-war teach-ins earlier in the decade. The response was nothing short of remarkable. Anyway, he used a $125,000 grant to set up a staff, and then the Nixon White House was opposed, but political pressure built up so that a few federal agencies helped prepare materials. No very precise calculation of the number of participants is possible, but April 22 of 1970 saw probably the largest of all the demonstrations of the 60s. According to the organizers, 1,500 colleges and 10,000 schools took part. Many campuses had street demonstrations and parades, and large rallies were held in New York, Washington, and San Francisco. Time estimated that some 20 million people were part of what Nelson called truly an astonishing grassroots explosion. There were some who denounced Earth Day as a communist plot. The Daughters of the American Revolution, for example, declared it was subversive. But it's a matter of 60s radicalism that a greater number protested it as an establishment plot, an attempt to get the attention of youth and students away from the war and civil rights and back to something that could be discussed in reasonable circles. Certainly the fact that many mainstream politicians gave their support, including a number of Nixon cabinet officers, suggested that environmentalism was more acceptable than black power or anti-war opposition. And the fact that certain conservative foundations like Resources for the Future and the Conservation Foundation provided finances suggested that this message was not thought to be all that subversive. Ramparts, a short-lived left-wing California magazine, devoted a special issue to Earth Day finances, arguing that its intention was not a true preservation of the Earth, but merely a more efficient rape of resources. But whether or not it could muster mainstream support, Earth Day 1970 was in fact a surprising demonstration of the depth of feeling about environmentalism at that time. Earth Day, in the New Republic said, was not just a channel for frustrated anti-war energies, as we had thought. Before the affair, it had dismissed environmentalists as the biggest assortment of ill-matched allies since the Crusades, but rather an event that signaled an awakening to the dangers in a dictatorship of technology. Nobody uses that kind of language anymore. So that's Earth Day. But I think that critique of the contradictions that, you know, it was more palatable to the, you know, the less radical minded of people. And it, you know, it didn't necessarily direct attention to the origins, as people say, like Barry Commoner, who's both a socialist and a very important voice of on environmental issues. His was a much more systemic critique. Although, you know, within the environmental movement, systemic critiques have also developed since. Okay, I'm probably trying to do too much. I could go through this really quickly, but I kind of wanted to get to, as I said, direct action. Of course, Greenpeace, came into existence in, I think it was 1971 or two, began, it's 1971. So that was kind of the origins, although I understand that, one of the first forest direct action, I believe, took place in 1969 in Northern California. So, you know, that was well before Earth First came on the scene. But Greenpeace did, you know, really introduce the idea of environmental direct action to the broader, although, you know, again, you know, back in the 50s, there were locals in Appalachia who were actually sitting in the scoops of bulldozers and blocking strip mines that were going on. And of course, that movement against strip mining was probably the most vibrant. And again, it wasn't just an environmental movement. It was a community defense movement, because those strip mines were just devastating those Appalachian communities as well as the land. But that was a movement that, you know, was well before the modern environmental movement began. And it was a basically a grassroots local movement that then actually was taken over by some of the bigger environmental organizations like the Sierra Club, for example. And they ended up with a very watered down bill, which basically mandated that they do some reparation to the land after they do the strip mines. And it had a loophole that allowed mountaintop removal, so couldn't have been that strong. So yeah, that's something I've talked about as well, the dichotomy between grassroots, more radical movements, and the tendency for the big national groups to opt for more watered-down reforms. Okay, so let's jump to, so then the 1970s saw a lot more organizations like Environmental Action, which was one of the most aggressive of the Washington-based groups. Some of these became lobbying organizations, like the Public Interest Research Group, Environmental Action. So they moved from just focusing on creating legislation, like the Wilderness Act and some of the others, and actually lobbying to on issues of toxic waste, nuclear power, and energy policy. And of course, Greenpeace, as I said, with their, going out in their rubber rafts and trying to stop the whale hunts, et cetera, seal hunts initially, I believe. Environmentalists for Full Employment, started by Richard Grossman in 1975. Was an effort to confront the claim corporations were increasingly making that restrictions on pollution and waste could cost jobs. Of course, we saw that in the Pacific Northwest with this idea that the, you know, protecting the spotted owl would do away with jobs, when of course it was mostly the mechanization of the industry that was doing away with workers' jobs. World Watch Institute, primarily a research and publication, was begun by Lester Brown in 1975. And of course, the Center for Marine Conservation, Citizens for a Better Environment, the Cousteau Society, Earthwatch, Food First, Hunger Project, et cetera, all in the 1970s. Then we get to Reagan and the one of the big hallmarks of Reaganism, in addition to the institution of neoliberal, the drastic imposition of neoliberal capitalism, going back to deregulation, was also in the realm of the environment and sort of defanging a lot of the, the Environmental Protection Agency and the Interior Department, defanging them from actually becoming stewards of the resources and lands and allowing corporations much more access. And so one of the reactions to Reaganism, and more a reaction to the frustration of the lack of wider protection for wilderness areas, of course, Earth First burst onto the scene in 1981, I believe it was. I should know, since I was involved in Earth First. Okay, so that brings us to what I wanted to talk about, which was direct action. It took a while to get there, I know. Looks like we have a caller, 503-231-8187. I just want to read a few things. What is direct action? Direct action is a phrase that gets thrown around a lot when describing anarchist tactics. Well, let's go to a different one here. Wikipedia. Direct action organized is a political activist term for economic and political acts in which actors use their power, such as economic or physical power, to directly achieve their goals. In contrast, actions that appeal to others might achieve their goals by, for example, highlighting an existing problem to the public or demonstrating a possible solution to authorities. By contrast, electoral politics, diplomacy, negotiation, and arbitration are not usually described as direct action since they are electorally mediated. Oh, that's not such a great one. Direct action, simply put, means cutting out the middleman, solving problems yourself rather than petitioning the authorities or relying on external institutions. Any action that sidesteps regulations and representation to accomplish goals directly is direct action. It includes everything from blockading airports to helping refugees escape to safety and organizing programs to liberate your community from reliance on capitalism. This is from Crime Think, and they have a step-by-step guide. And I could just go on. Basically, we're talking about strikes. We're talking about boycotts. We're talking about sit-ins. We're talking about tree sits. We're talking about taking direct steps, economically, directly putting yourself in between whatever is going to, damage or destroy or oppress. And so, let's see. We already got a caller. I believe it's Norm. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Paul. I like your show. And, I'm getting a lot of information, that I'm going to have a hard time remembering. And I was wondering if you could recommend me some books to read by somebody.
Reading from, as I said, The Green Revolution, The American Environmental Movement, 1962 to 1992 by Kirkpatrick Sale.
I got that.
And I also recommend this Do or Die, Voices from the Ecological Resistance, which is now, I think the last one they published was almost maybe 20 years ago. But so that's a historical. Those are two. I've got a whole bunch around me. I was going to talk about the Luddites as another few centuries after the Diggers, couple centuries after the Diggers. Rebels Against the Future by Kirkpatrick Sale, The Luddites and Their War on the Industrial Revolution. Oh, God, I got so many here. Let me just read a few more that I recommend. Against the Mega Machine, Essays on Empire and Its Enemies by David Watson. I suppose I should probably just do a program page for this show, which I had failed to do initially, and give all these names of these books.
You're doing a really good job. I'm getting a lot of really great information. Really, thank you, Paul.
Well, you're welcome. I appreciate that. Any more comments?
No. Be safe. Be well.
All right. Thanks, Norm. I don't know. There's a whole bunch. These are just sort of. I have a lot of ones having to do with the radical environmental movement. Eco Warriors: Understanding the Radical Environmental Movement by Rick R.I.K. Scarce is a good one. The Ecocentrists: A History of Radical Environmentalism. There's just so much out there, but how to actually do direct action, how to, get together with people that you trust to do direct action. That's, I guess, what I wanted to talk about. And I want to talk about, your personal experiences with direct action, which, I was thinking is, I contrast it to a passive-aggressive behavior, which is just Wikipedia, which is characterized by a pattern of passive hostility and avoidance of direct communication. Inaction, where some action is socially customary, is a typical passive-aggressive strategy. Anyway, that's more in daily life. But yeah, I think we tend to be so stymied by, you know, the vast forces arrayed against our, you know, our living free and healthy lives. All of us, you know, but obviously especially some classes of people, some people who have different colors of skin, maybe speak a different language, are poorer than others, are particularly targeted. And we're so stymied in this world. And some of us just by our social conditioning to not stand up, not speak out. We tend to act out in more passive aggressive ways. Whereas I think taking direct action, like standing up to someone who, you know, is doing microaggressions to you or who is oppressing you in one way or another, or institutions, that, you know, it can build on itself. Or, you know, in lots of many parts of the world, unfortunately, direct action can often or always land you in prison or dead. So there are very good reasons in some circumstances. So, you know, one has to be crafty sometimes. One has to be careful. One has to think things through. One doesn't necessarily just want to act out, you know. What is direct action in our society looks like? You know, somebody who grows up dysfunctional and has access to firearms and shoots up. That's their direct action. So yeah, not all direct action is good or useful. Clearly, we're talking about something else. So, you know, that's an important part of the conversation as well. Anyway, yeah, I wanted to hear what your experiences are with direct action. And, you know, did it bring results? Was it useful? Did you learn something? So with that, that's what I want to talk about. It looks like we got a couple people on the stack. First up is Edie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, quite well.
So I'm answering your earlier question about why do direct action and its consequences. If it is good intended for the greater good, direct action is empowering for the individuals who do it. It's inspiring. It prevents PTSD in the sense that you're not helpless. You know the rest of your life that you can make choices in any given moment, and how you respond to situations, how proactive you're going to be, what values you're going to live, and that you have integrity to your values and self-respect. It is inspiring and uplifting to others. You can do direct action for the greater good individually, secretly, anonymously, more like I do, or you can do it with trusted affinity groups. Sometimes there's some betrayal or things going wrong, but you know that you were true to your highest sense of right, and you can learn to have grace and empathy for your humanity and that of others that you may have thought have failed you. But each time, each one of us exercises our moral muscle of courage, of caring, of compassion, of integrity, we get stronger and we strengthen our community. We strengthen the moral ecosystem around us and we improve society. So it's never wasted. I know that the oppressors want to make us think that we were wrong, we're crazy, it's useless. But the higher in the Christian tradition, the more Christy or more you align with Christ, the more you're going to have the Antichrist. Well, you don't give up over that. The more in the journalist, scientist, whistleblower tradition, the more you speak up for truth and live a life of truth, the more the anti-truth attacks you. But that's okay. That's how we get stronger. That's how we make a better world. And if you're going to die anyway, you might as well die with self-respect and that gratitude and that inner little giggle about the good that you did. I really strongly recommend it.
Awesome. Not much to add to that. I guess one thing, I don't know if you brought this up, but one thing that my experience has been, I feel almost privileged or blessed to have been part of some movements that just sprang up and just became like way bigger than anybody could have imagined at the start. So direct action inspires, because when people see courageous example of people doing things that, you know, maybe they had never thought possible, maybe in their secret heart of hearts, they might have wanted to do, but didn't see a way to do it, or didn't see a place to, you know, it can build on itself. It can be a what they call a virtuous cycle, as opposed to so many of the vicious cycles we see.
And it can be small. When someone is bad-mouthing or using a bad joke, you can stand up and say that's not funny and show compassion and listen to someone, side with someone. It means you pull your car over the side of the road and intervene when there's domestic violence or bullying. It means that you reprimand the security guard in a way that is appropriate and de-escalates, but role models what it should be. It's a way in which you grow food for folks, or you go out and you check on folks, you shovel their the sidewalk. There's any number of things. You can start small and build your muscle like you would if you're an ultra runner, but you at least put on your shoes morally and you go out there and you take a few steps. And so when you're motivated by love and you have the humility to keep listening and adapting and being creative, and then you forgive yourself because you haven't learned everything and there's still more to do, that empowers people and heals people who've never heard of you, never seen it, don't know the action, but it kind of uplifts and cleanses the whole air in which we all live. So I strongly believe it's good for all, and I'm going to hang up and let others talk.
Thank you so much, Edie. And you know, one thing that just popped in my mind, I ended up helping my mother buy a house and moving her out here from the East Coast to live with her and take care of her. And I kind of wanted a big lot to grow a nice big garden, and because I've been a gardener for a long time. But what I had, the sunny open spot, was actually a gravel, pressed gravel with black plastic, like several inches of gravel, very compacted with black plastic, a sheet of black plastic. So I had to very painstakingly go around and get all the gravel out. And I think they had used herbicides too. So I got all the layer of gravel, took the black plastic off, broke that hard pan. And over the years, I've amended it with mostly my own house compost, kitchen and leaves and other things that I get around. Anyway, and with the very kind of nice rock or wood borders for the raised beds. And I don't know, I've just noticed that people kind of like it in the neighborhood. I get conversations, and I like to think other people have started gardens, but inspired
by... this is an example.
Oh, I thought you were leaving.
Okay. He founded the Home Garden Project that became the Growing Gardens. And
right on.
For folks who want to do what Paul did, you can plant daikon, radish, and asparagus, and they'll dig down deep and break up the soil for
okay,
you.
Okay, sorry, I thought you were already hung up, but sorry, you surprised me. But okay, we do have a couple other callers. Thank you, Edie. Yeah, that just surprised me. That's great, though. No, there's community gardens. That's a form of direct action, I guess is what I'm saying. You know, if you got to look at the outside, step outside the box, basically. Okay, we got two more callers and maybe more coming, and we're rapidly running out of time. Arthur, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Good morning. Great call from Edie. I was at the, this is indirectly related. I was at the Lloyd Center walking around that, park, and I saw this woman punching another woman on the ground in the head, and the woman she was punching was already unconscious, and she kept hitting her. So I busted that fight up, and this was right by the train station. I busted that fight up, and then her boyfriend came around and threatened to kill me, and I look over my shoulder, and guess what all the people, including the security guard, were doing on the train station.
Watching?
They were watching and taking cell phone video.
Oh, my God.
They weren't helping.
Oh, my
God.
They
weren't helping at all. So I'm trying to stop a murder, and they're just watching. And this brings me to my point. Whenever you take direct action, there's always some danger involved to you personally. You know, that's something to take into consideration. But I would recommend taking direct action anyway, because that's how you stop dictatorships, etc. When George Floyd was murdered, I guarantee you there were 100 people standing around, but they didn't want to take a bullet from those policemen. And I understand that. I fully understand that.
Right. Well, yeah, and every situation is different, too. So, you know, some direct actions have relatively low risks involved, but not necessarily those are the ones we always should take. But, you know, it's not, I guess I'm just saying it's not going to be always dangerous. And also, you know, maybe you can start out small, and you know, having the force of numbers with you always helps too.
I think so, definitely. Automobiles in general, you know, they cause all the air pollution, noise pollution. Children can't play across the street safely anymore, right? I've got a question for you real quick, and then I'll let you go. Do the mayor and the city councilors, do they ever ride the train and the bus? What do you think about that?
I don't know. I know Bud Clark used to ride his bike around. That was a big thing.
I don't know.
That's a good question. But yeah, lead by example, I guess. Then there have been public figures who have very consciously done that, led by example. You know, Jimmy Carter, president, putting solar panels on the White House. Those are, you know, I think public figures almost, I think, have a duty to leverage their visibility and their power to do things, you know, because sometimes small, you know, thing, just mundane things that they do have a outsized impact. So anyway, yeah, that's a good point to bring up. Thank you, Arthur, and Edie and Norm. It looks like Camilo's up next, and you too can call 503-231-8187. I suspect I open up the phones a little late because this is a very interesting conversation. Go ahead, Camilo.
Hi. I want to address a couple of points. One about the question about literature. I would look closely at the book by Maria Ressa, the woman who won the Nobel Prize in 2021, along with a Russian journalist. And the point of this book, I think, is that resistance is really necessary. Otherwise, we're in for severe trouble, and the way things are moving, and that's the direction of fascism. But the point about direct action that comes out of that book is that all the effort done to resist through the journalism would have been jeopardized, and you know, possibly even leading to her murder, if it had not been for a community of people who supported her and who assisted her, and she would not have been able to do it without having people together. So I think one aspect of direct action that's essential is organizing and having a body of visible support that has some strength and power behind it.
Right on.
You know, just looking at the concept of direct action, I mean, there's direct action that just tries to demonstrate, make visible issues that need attention. But I think that what you're talking about is something that really confronts the powers that be in order to change the system.
Indeed.
And in order to do that, we need communities of solidarity, and we need coalitions of communities of solidarity. So it's got to start small, big, get bigger in the community and move to the national and global arenas.
Sounds like a tall order, but again, just real quickly, I know we got John and Elliot on stack here, so thanks, Camilo. My experience with, say, Earth First was that it did just that. I mean, we started by trying to protect some areas of the last old growth native forest on the west slope of the Cascade Mountains. And in doing that, we had no idea where it would go, but it blossomed. Earth First, you know, wasn't just that. It was already more widespread. But the forest protection movement had massive implications. Ultimately, you know, it led to the creation of the Rainforest Action Network, within which was in solidarity with indigenous groups in rainforests around the world. It had multiplier effects, and it ended up being part of the anti globalization or global justice movement of the 1990s, you know, which helped shut down the WTO in Seattle in 1999, et cetera. So, yeah, again, it sounds like a big thing, but yeah, starting small, starting local, and then seeing where that takes you, basically. Thank you, Camilo. John's up next. Go ahead. You're on the air.
The leverage of like-minded communities is absolutely at the essence, and I want to applaud the subject matter. I'd like to challenge all Oregonians over 60 to get engaged and involved. And I'll give you a quick little example. I'm a globally published commercial photographer, and in the last 14 years, I got exposed to the Cheetah Conservation Fund out in Namibia. But they happen to have a captive cheetah breeding program at the Oregon Wildlife Safari. So pro bono, I went out of my way to shoot and try to get some heroic portraits of some cheetahs in Oregon. I had a whole ad campaign created by some Madison Avenue art director, creative directors type. This is all in the last 7 years. And I spent about a half a year in the last 5 years trying to get these ads run for free. And I was not successful. I have not given up. But it's going to take the like-minded collective to get together and leverage their equity. That's all I want to say.
Thank you, John. All right. Looks like Elliot is going to probably be our last caller. We only have about 4 minutes left. Go ahead, Elliot.
Well, the 2 points that I want to make is first, I happened to be in the audience a few years ago when you actually introduced Chris Hedges for a talk, and on that Memorial Day weekend, I think it was Memorial Day, there was the multiple stabbing murder that took place because somebody tried to take direct action to deter someone who was harassing a woman, I think with a hijab, and got stabbed to death for it. It shook everybody up, you know, when that weekend when you introduced Chris Hedges. But
surely you're not linking those two events.
No, not at all. What I'm saying is that's the inherent risk.
Right.
But non-zero risk of direct action.
Right.
But that's a
very particular example where you're confronting someone physically. Well, however, you know, essentially he was physically confronting the person. He was standing right in their face. And yeah, that's very different from the, in general, I think, from the more kind of political kind of direct action where we're talking about sit-ins, strikes, boycotts, you know, tree sits, blockades, and that sort of thing, or just a mass, you know, protests. But yeah, so I think it's important to make that distinction.
On a different level, though, because I think this is systemically important for the efficacy of the left. You have to have priorities. If it might be a great idea in terms of a slogan, you know, that renewable energy is national security, to fight with direct mass action to get a conversion of a certain percentage of the defense budget into rapid expansion of renewable energy. But if some crazy leftist coterie stands up and says, well, yeah, but we also have to have massive appropriations to pay reparations either to blacks or even better, let's pay reparations to gays for what happened to gays 200 years ago.
I don't know what
we can't afford all that.
I don't know what the heck you're talking about. I think this is actually somewhat inappropriate, actually.
No.
Yeah.
It's strategic.
I think you're mixing apples and oranges here. Anyway, we're just about out of time. So thank you, Elliot, for calling. I don't know. That seems to be basically an intersectional analysis that Elliot is proposing, I would have to say. But anyway, and especially when you start talking about stuff like that at the very end of the hour, it tends to really kind of mess things up because we have to unpack such things. How to go after the defense budget. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we have massive military bases. There are small groups in battle groups that have been protesting the presence of the U.S. military including the presence of nuclear weapons and others. And I need to get them on this show at some point, but that's where we need to focus. And the, you know, the big defense industry arms fairs, the gun fairs, doing direct action, doing protests there, along the lines of what Elliot was talking about, is the massive bloated defense budget, the arms industry, et cetera. That's where, in terms of direct action, that's where I would take it. But we are out of time. I gotta go right now. Thanks, everybody, for calling. Thanks for listening. Thanks for Ty for running the board. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Soul Queens and Blues Kings, making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Norman Boogie Cat Sylvester and Band bring together regional rhythm and blues acts for a night of music and dance as a benefit for healthcare for all Oregon. Again, that's Soul Queens and Blues Kings making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.